So I think I shared, probably a couple weeks ago, I'm not really sure or not, that Kimberly has been on this mission, I think, to share the gospel with every Mexican in the state of Kentucky. There's this little Mexican restaurant called El Jalisco's, which is right by the Ark. There's not a whole lot of restaurants in Williamstown, but just around the corner from the Ark is this authentic Mexican restaurant, and it's always packed. And it's one of these places where the tables are so close, you almost have to, you know, work your way to get through them and stuff. And it's always packed. It's great food. And so, you know, obviously it attracts a lot of the kids from the Ark housing and stuff like that. So, but Kimberly had gotten this into her head that God was calling her to share the gospel with Mexicans. And so she has been handwriting her own tracts using Google Translate and drawing little pictures and stuff, and then buys some tracks from the Ark that are already professional tracks that are in Spanish. And then she's got a list of Mexican restaurants, and she wants to go to them and basically share the gospel with the waiters and waitresses and staff and stuff. And even to the point where she's talked about, you know, like at El Jalisco, she went and handed out a whole stack of stuff and wanted them to hand it off to their staff and things like that. Well, so all that to say that a while back, as this was all coming to fruition, she called me and she was kind of frustrated because her and some of her friends had plans to go to El Jalisco, and Kimberly had done all these Bible tracks, and it was all about, you know, going there to share the gospel with the staff there. And they didn't invite one particular friend to go with them because this girl had a reputation of being very flirtatious, and Kimberly and some of her friends were like, we don't really want to invite her along because we think that would be a distraction. And just didn't want that distraction. And, you know, Kimberly, in her mind, you know, she's very black and white, wants everything to go exactly as planned, you know. And, well, anyway, this young lady invited herself along. And so Kimberly was frustrated with that and everything. So they end up going, and it kind of, if I understood Kimberly correctly, it played out the way that she kind of thought it would. That the girl behaved in a way that, in hindsight, Kimberly said, I don't think she was deliberately trying to flirt, but it certainly came across that way, and it led to a bunch of distractions with some of the guys there, the waiters and that, and they even started asking maybe some questions that were, I wouldn't say inappropriate, but kind of like totally off track. Well, how old are you girls? And all that kind of stuff, you know? And Kimberly was so flustered by that and frustrated. She's still thinking about, well, now how do we do this, you know? And so she makes this attempt to kind of share with the guys, and just the whole thing went sideways. Kimberly's stumbling over her words and doesn't know what to say, and she's nervous, and when she gets nervous, it's not good. So anyway, so she tried to share with these guys and gave them the Bible tracts and stuff that she had done, and she was so discouraged by that. And so she had called me, and again, all just totally discouraged, like, you know, this is, look at what happened, and I know I didn't really want her to go along. This is how I thought it was going to happen, and, you know, I think I just totally destroyed any opportunity I might have to witness to these people, and oh, what a mess it was. And so I had to talk her off the ledge. And I just said, Kimberly, you know what? You couldn't control any of that. And do you really think that God isn't going to honor what you guys attempted to do tonight? She's like, yeah, but you know, I just was flumbering. You know how it is. You make a mess out of things, and it's really bad. And I said, hey, look, I've had plenty of opportunities where I've really screwed up, and I think I've done more damage in trying to share the gospel with somebody than I did actually share the gospel with them. I said, what's that? Have her call Dustin. Yeah. So I tried to talk her off the ledge, and she said, honey, don't worry about it. God's word. I said, your Bible tracts had God's word written on it. I said, he promises us that his word will not return void. It may not be used the way we want it to be used. Maybe you weren't used the way you want it to be used. But you know what? This is in God's hands. You were faithful. You attempted to share the gospel. You couldn't control all these things. God will use it somehow, some way. Because that's the way God is. You just have to be faithful. And you can't be discouraged now. You can't use this now to prevent you from sharing the gospel. And as I shared, I think last week, she's still on that mission and made me go out to eat at a Mexican restaurant with her a couple of weeks ago, and we ended up being able to share the gospel with our waiter, and it went very well. She was really encouraged. But I share this example this morning because we oftentimes don't realize that And I know in our head we do, but in our heart we don't. God can use anything. In fact, often does. And many times he uses people that we don't think he'll use. He uses circumstances and situations we don't think he would use. He can even use evil, wicked situations and even evil, wicked people, unworthy people. God will accomplish his mission, will he not? We're going to see a great example of that today because we're going to see two individuals. One of them is Judah, one of the sons of Jacob, and the other one is his wife or his daughter-in-law. Neither one of them are people that you would think that God would use as part of his redemptive plan, but we see that he does. And so what I'm going to do today is I'm going to look at first Judah. My main point with him is that there's nothing about Judah that would suggest that he would play a role in God's redemptive plan. Second thing we're going to do is we're going to look at his daughter-in-law, Tamar, and it's going to be a very similar thing. There is nothing about her that would suggest that God would use her as part of his redemptive plan. And then lastly, we'll kind of wrap it up, that despite what we learn about Judah and Tamar, we discover that God did indeed use them as part of his redemptive plan. So I'm going to leave all the takeaways till the end. But let's go ahead and we'll start with Judah. Chapter 38, verses 1 through 11. There's nothing about Judah that we learn here that would suggest that God would use him as part of his redemptive plan. Let's just look at verses 1 through 11 of chapter 38. And it came about at that time that Judah departed from his brothers. Remember, he's a son of Jacob. And it says that he visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Herah. Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he took her and went into her. So she conceived and bore a son and named him Ur. Then she conceived again and bore a son and named him Onan. She bore still another son and named him Shelah, and it was at Chezeb that she bore him. Now Judah took a wife for Ur for his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord took his life. Then Judah came or said to Onan, "Go into your brother's wife and perform your duty as a brother-in-law to her and raise up offspring for her or for your brother." Onan knew that the offspring would not be his, so he went into his brother's wife. He wasted his seed on the ground in order to not give offspring to his brother. But what he did was displeasing in the sight of the Lord, so he took his life also. Then Judah said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, "Remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up." For he thought, "I am afraid that he might also die like his brothers." So Tamar went and lived in her father's house. So we got our first look at Judah back in chapter 37. He was the one who basically came up with a plan to sell Joseph into Egypt. So what we learn about him is there was something faulty about his character. He wasn't a very admirable man. Look back at chapter 37, verse 25. Chapter 37, verse 25. They had thrown Joseph into the pit. The plan was basically to leave him there while he died. But, verse 25, "Then they sat down to eat a meal, and they raised their eyes and looked, and behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead with their camels bearing aromatic gum and balm and myrrh on their way to bring them down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, 'What profit, what gain is there for us if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh, and his brothers listened to him.' Then the Midianite traders passed by, so they pulled him up and lifted Joseph out of the pit, sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Thus they brought Joseph into Egypt." So Judah was the one who came up with the plan to sell his brother. It tells us almost everything we need to know about Judah. But we get a further picture of his character in chapter 38 this morning. And just like that first introduction, it's not very flattering. In fact, in many respects, it's almost wicked. I'm going to look at five different things here about Judah and his character. The first thing we see is that he left his family and he moved to a Canaanite city. So the first thing we see here is that he moved to a Canaanite city. We learn that Judah, it says, departed from his brothers and visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Herah. The NASB translation uses the word visited here, which suggests that he simply went for a weekend trip or a short stop. But the Hebrew word has a wide range of meanings here. The New American Standard translates it as visited, as we see here. The Legacy Standard Bible says he turned aside. The NET and the NIV say that he stayed with Haran. The one that's most intriguing to me is the Christian Holman Standard Version, which says that he settled near Haran. Or he settled near Haran. And I think this translation probably captures it best, because that implies that it wasn't just a short visit. That he actually went down with the intent to stay with this individual named Haran in the land of Canaan. So I believe that the Christian Holman Standard Version has it right when they say he settled near. Because that's actually what he did. He was there for an extended period of time. So this wasn't just some real quick visit that he went down to visit a friend and come back home. The text tells us that Haran was an Adullamite, which means that he was from a place called Adullam. It's a Canaanite city, approximately 15 to 20 minutes northwest of Hebron, where his family had lived. Now we know that he didn't visit there, but settled, because in verse 5 we learn that after he got married, had multiple children, had wives for those children, or a wife for those children, he was still living in a place called Chezeb, which was 4 to 5 miles north of Adullam. So he didn't just visit, he went and he camped down there, he made it his home, he stayed there. And again, we have to remember that this was a Canaanite city. He left the family, and remember that this is, we're talking about the formation of Israel here. They were supposed to be in the land of Canaan. God was going to use them to build the nation of Israel. And he leaves. Leaves his family, goes down to a Canaanite city, and makes it his home. It appears that his intent was to stay there. Something else we learn about Judah, the second thing, is that he was close personal friends with Haran, a Canaanite. Twice in the upcoming verses, Haran is referred to Judah as his friend. So look at verse 30, or chapter 38, verse 12. We'll get to this in a moment. Now after a considerable time, Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died, and when the time of mourning was ended, Judah went up to his sheep shears at Timnah. He, and look at what it says here, and his friend Haran, the Adullamite. So we find that it's his friend. We jump down to verse 20. Then Judah went or sent the young goat by his friend, the Adullamite. So twice in the upcoming verses, it refers to this man he went to visit or stay with as a friend. And these verses suggest that he was more than just an acquaintance, but rather close friends, quite possibly his best friend. And the reason I suggest that is because we find out a little bit later that after he had visited the prostitute and went to collect his belongings, it says that he sent this man Haran for him. He went and did his task for him. So it appears that they were extremely close, possibly the best of friends. In fact, Haran would spend time with him, travel with him. They went together to look at their sheep. He sent Haran on missions for him. So it implies, again, more than just a casual acquaintance with this Canaanite, but rather a deeply personal relationship with him. The third thing we learn about Judah is that he married a Canaanite woman. Look at verses 2 and 5 again. Judah saw there a daughter, saw there meaning where? In the Canaanite city. He saw a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he took her and went into her. So she conceived and bore a son, and he named him Ur. She then conceived again and bore a son and named him Onan. She bore still another and named him Shelah. What we find is that Judah married a Canaanite woman, had three children by her. Now this should immediately set off some red flags for us. We've already learned what marrying a Canaanite woman might lead to. In fact, Abraham forbid his servant from finding a wife for Isaac from among the Canaanites. Isaac forbid Jacob from taking a wife among the Canaanites. If you remember, Esau actually married a couple of Canaanite women and made life miserable for his parents. Drove a wedge. The problem with marrying Canaanite women is that the Canaanites were pagans who worshipped false gods. They engaged in wicked cultic practices, often involving sex and other things, but most egregiously, child sacrifice. It was well known who the Canaanites were, which is likely why Abraham and Isaac prohibited their children from marrying Canaanite women. It's why we see the division between Esau and his parents because of these Canaanite women. In fact, if you think about Solomon, who happened to have 600 or 700 wives and 300 concubines or something along that order, all from among the Canaanites and the pagans, and he built temples for them, and the text literally tells us that they led his heart away from the Lord. And so here we have this individual, Judah, who's supposed to be part of the foundation and the formation of Israel, who marries himself a Canaanite wife and essentially has a Canaanite family. That was diametrically opposed to what God intended for the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But instead of following in the footsteps of Isaac and Jacob and finding a wife among his relatives, Judah followed in the footsteps of Esau and married a Canaanite woman. The fourth thing we learn about Judah is that his sons were so wicked that God killed them. Look at verses 6 through 10 again. Now Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar, so this is now his son, Ur. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord took his life. And tells us nothing else about him. His whole entire legacy, Ur's legacy, in the scriptures, is simply, he was so wicked that God had to snuff him out. How'd you like that to be your legacy? Again, doesn't tell us anything about him. But that is certainly some kind of wickedness. If the Lord saw as the only alternative, take his life. Again, we don't know what he did. So the fourth thing we learn about Judah there is that his one son there was so wicked God took his life, but it doesn't just stop there because his second son, Onan, really didn't fare much better. Look at verse 8. Then Judah said to Onan, "Go into your brother's wife and perform your duty as a brother-in-law to her and raise up offspring for your brother." What he's talking about there is something called levirate marriage, which is essentially was common in the ancient Near East. It actually became part of the Old Testament law. Okay? The older brother was typically the one who would get married first. If he were to happen to die without offspring, then it was expected culturally that his brother would marry the widow and would therefore produce offspring in the name of the older son. So the child really wouldn't be his. Legally, it would be his older brother's, and that way it would carry on the older brother's name. That was an expectation in the culture and the society during this time. It's also something God put into the law. And part of that was because each of the 12 tribes, he wanted to make sure that they would continue to maintain their legacy and their lineage. And so if a son died without being able to produce offspring, a brother would marry his wife and produce offspring in his name to carry on the name of his brother. And so that's what's supposed to be happening here, but what actually happens? Well, Onan, because he understands this and he realizes, well, it's not going to really be my son, he was willing to go in and to have sex with his brother's wife, but he wasn't willing to provide offspring for her. And so he practiced a form of birth control that we're all familiar with. He had sex, but refused to provide the sperm necessary for her to produce a child. And so what happens to him? Well, verse 9, Onan knew that the offspring would not be his, so when he went into his brother's wife, he wasted his seed on the ground in order to not give offspring to his brother. But what he did was displeasing in the sight of the Lord, so he took his life also. So here Judah has these two sons. First one, God just tells us he kills, doesn't tell us why. Second one, we know why. He was wicked, not doing what was expected. It was something that dishonored and displeased the Lord. Again, going in and having sex with his brother's widowed wife, but not providing what is expected. Selfish motives there. And so God takes his life as well. What a legacy for his sons. Fourth thing we learn about Judah, The fifth thing that we learn about Judah is that, like Onan, his second son, he also refused to fulfill his obligation to his first son. So not only did his son Onan refuse to do what was expected, even Judah himself didn't do what was expected. Look back at verse 11. Then Judah said to his daughter-in-law, "Remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up. For he thought, I'm afraid that he too may die like his brothers." So Tamar went and lived with her, or in her father's house. So basically what happens here is Judah knows what's expected. He's got three sons. First son dies without offspring. So he sends his second son to produce offspring with his first son's wife. And he doesn't do that either. So now he dies without offspring. So then naturally, what would be the next thing that's expected? To take his third and only son and fulfill the obligation to his previous sons. But instead, he's too afraid. He's afraid that if he does that, his third son's going to die too. Which is a little interesting to me, because he should have been aware that the reason the first two died was because they were wicked. Had nothing to do with Tamar. It's not like she snuffed him out. But instead, he's afraid. And so he lies to her, deceives her, says, "Well, why don't you just, the youngest one isn't quite old enough." Now, that's possible. We don't know the age of the youngest one. I suspect he was more than old enough, because the first two sons obviously were old enough. And there's no indication that there was a long gap. The indication is she had three kids. Boom, boom, boom. But let's give him the benefit of the doubt. Maybe Shelah was a little bit too young. Well, except the rest of the passage tells us that he never really intended. He simply told her to go back home to your father, and later he just doesn't give her his son. When her son is old enough, he still refused. And so this is a ruse. It's deception. He never had an intent to give his third son and fulfill the obligation to either one of his sons, his firstborn son, who died without offspring, or the second one, who also died without offspring. Now, there's a few more things that we'll see regarding Judah's character in the upcoming verses. But the thing I wanted to focus on here is everything we've seen about Judah up until this point, there's nothing about it that suggests that God would select this man to be a part of his redemptive plan, or any plan for that matter. So far, there's no redeeming value in this individual. Can we agree on that? Or am I being a little bit too harsh on Judah? There really isn't. And in our worldview, oftentimes we think God uses the righteous, but he doesn't use the unrighteous. So our assumption at this point is he's out of the picture, right? So hold on to that thought. Just as there was nothing in Judah's character that would suggest that he would become a part of God's redemptive plan, we would have to say the same thing about Tamar. We're in verses 12 through 30 here. Let's just read the first couple of verses. When Judah failed to fulfill his duty and promise to Tamar, she came up with her own really cunning plan. Look at verses 12 through 13. Now, after a considerable time, that really means after a long time. So after a considerable time, Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, Tamar, I'm sorry, Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. And when the time of mourning was ended, Judah went up to his sheep shears at Timnah, he and his friend Hira with the Adullamite. And it was told to Tamar, "Behold, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep." So she removed her widow's garments and covered herself with a veil and wrapped herself and sat in the gateway of Anaim, which is on the road to Timnah, for she saw that Shelah had grown up and she had not been given to him as a wife. So what's going on here? Well, basically, after a considerable amount of time, Judah's wife, Shua, dies. So what he does, he takes his buddy and he decides to go up and check on his sheep shears up in another city. And word is given to Tamar, the fact that he's now gone, at least for a short period of time, and it kind of dawns on her, you know, he's never going to give me his third son as a husband. He's not going to fulfill what's expected. So she comes up with this plan. And it says here that she removed her widow's garments, and she covered herself with a veil, and she wrapped herself up. But then she traveled to a place called Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. So he went up to Timnah to check on his sheep. And she goes, follows the route, and stops at this city, Enaim. And she takes up a position at the gate wearing specific clothes and a veil. Now we know, based on what we know about ancient Near Eastern culture, that she was dressed like a prostitute. That's what she did. In fact, the text will confirm that in a minute here. So essentially, the plan is that she's going to go up and try to solicit her father-in-law. And that's exactly what we see. She must have known Judah pretty well, because upon him seeing her sitting there, he propositions her for sex. Look at verses 15 through 19. When Judah saw her, so apparently he was passing by, he saw her sitting there in the gate, he thought she was a harlot. Now, it tells us here, for she had covered her face, which is telling us something about prostitutes during those days. They would cover their faces. And this idea here that he thought she was a harlot, we're to interpret that not so much as he was walking by and went, interesting, she must be a harlot, her face is covered, and he kept moving. The idea here is that he's thinking of her as a harlot, and he's interested in the fact that she is a harlot. And so what happens? Verse 16, so he turned aside to her by the road and said to her, "Here now, let me come into you." We know what that means. For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. Why? Because her face was covered. And she said, "What will you give me that you may come into me?" He said, "Therefore, I will send you a goat, a young goat from the flock." She said, "Moreover, will you give a pledge until you send it?" He said, "What pledge shall I give you?" And she said, "Your seal and your cord and your staff that is in your hand." So he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. Then she arose and departed and removed her veil and put on her widow's garments. So her face is basically covered. He didn't recognize her. He simply assumed that she was a prostitute. It appears from the text here. He either was sort of enticed as he walked by and kind of went, "Huh, I like me some of that." Or he was seeking her out. Textually doesn't tell us. I don't know that it really matters. What matters is he saw her there and he thinks to himself to proposition her. "Let me come into you. What's it going to cost me to come into you?" I'm going to propose that there might have been another element here as well. Part of the purpose of these temple or these harlots, these cultic prostitutes, was it had something to do with their religion as well. And a little bit later, they specifically refer to her as a cultic prostitute. It may have been that Judah was engaging in sex with her as part of Canaanite cultic practices. We don't know. I don't want to read too much into it. But the fact is, he had married a Canaanite woman, lived in a Canaanite city. His best friend was Canaanite. He had raised children in a Canaanite environment. Should it shock us that he might behave or adopt? What happened to Israel in the land? They were told to kick out all the Canaanites. Why? Because if you leave them there, guess what? You'll become like the Canaanites. Next thing we know, they're sacrificing children to Baal or to Moloch. I don't think it's too much of a stretch to think that may be something for us to consider here. But either way, he propositions her. She wants to know how much she's going to get paid. He said, "I'll give you one of my goats." She realizes he's not traveling with some goat in his back pocket. So he can't pay her right then and there, so she's willing to do it on credit, but he has to give her some kind of pledge. This was all part of her plan. We learn this in a little bit. She had thought ahead. She knew he didn't travel with his goats. His goats are up in Timnah. He's a couple of miles south. So she's thinking. And so she basically, they agree on a price, a young goat, but she's going to need a pledge to make sure that he pays her for her services. So they agree that he would give her his signet, which was either a ring or a metal object or possibly stone that had his signet on it, identify who he is. She asked him for a cord that would be worn around the neck. So likely this probably wasn't a ring, but rather something he would wear around his neck. Typically kings and others, when they had their signets, would have either a ring or possibly something they wore on their neck. Here it appears that he wore this around his neck. Not that he was a king, but it was pretty common practice. We have our signature today. We sign things, right? Well, they had their signets. The last thing was his staff. All three of these things, his signet, the cord around his neck, and then the walking stick, would be identifiable as his. And so she asks him for that as a pledge, and ultimately he agrees. So he goes into her, they have sex, and behold, she conceives, but Judah ultimately remains completely clueless about what's happening. Look at verses 19 through 23. It says that she arose and departed and removed her veil and put on her widow's garment. So what does she do? Immediately she goes back home. He has no idea that she has conceived at this point. But she goes back home, puts her widow's clothes back on. When Judah sent the young goat by his friend, and here again, this is why I believe that there's probably more of a closer relationship between this guy. It's not just some acquaintance he knows, but he basically tells his buddy, hey, do me a favor. Go get my stuff. Take this payment with you. Go visit her. So he sends Hiram, the Adullamite, to go back and get the pledge from the woman's hand and to give her the goat. But he couldn't find her. Basically went back to Anaim, the city. So, verse 21. Here it asks the men of that place, saying, where is, and here it is, the temple prostitute? What does that tell us? It meant that both here and here, and then Judah knew that she was thought she was a temple prostitute, a cultic prostitute, having something to do with Canaanite religion. It says, where is she? She was by the road, but they said, there's been no temple prostitute here. So he returned to Judah and said, I did not find her, and furthermore, the men of the place said, there has been no temple prostitute here. So, essentially, what Judah does, he says, well, fine, let her keep them, which refers to all of it. The cords, probably the signet ring, the cord around the neck, the walking stick. He basically says, go ahead and let her keep it because we don't want to become a laughingstock. When word gets out that I've been duped by this prostitute, I'm going to look like a fool. So let's not, start telling people, well, we're trying to get back the signet ring and the walking stick. And just hush, hush, don't worry about it. Let her keep it. Nothing to see here. Move along. He says, after all, I did good on my part. I sent the goat, but you didn't find her. So he's off the hook now. He's done his part. All is good, right? So he agrees to basically let her keep these items. And we're going to find out that was a bit of a mistake. What we discover next is that Tamar was exceptionally cunning and knew all along that what she was doing. Look at verses 25 through 26 now. Well, we'll start at verse 24. Now, it was about 3 months later that Judah was informed, your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the harlot, and behold, she is also with child by harlotry. Then Judah said, bring her out and let her be burned. It's a little hard for a widow to hide a pregnancy. At some point, it's going to come out. And it did. She's supposed to be a widow. She's supposed to be waiting on Judah to provide his youngest son. But somehow she ends up pregnant. They make the proper assumption it's by harlotry. And they do what you might expect. They go running back to Judah now because it's his daughter-in-law. You won't believe what we just discovered. She's pregnant by harlotry. And look at Judah's response. Bring her out and let her be burned. Talk about hypocrisy, huh? He's livid. Probably because it makes him look bad. Verse 25. It was while she was being brought out that she sent to her father-in-law, she sends a message to him saying, I am with child by the man to whom these things belong. And she said, please examine these and see. Whose signet ring and cords and staff are these? Boy, talk about cunning. Verse 26, Judah recognized them. Can you imagine what he must have felt at that moment, seeing his signet ring and cord and staff show up? Got to be a million things going through his head. But look at his response. She is more righteous than I, inasmuch as I did not give her my son, Shelah. And he did not have relations with her again. This is rather interesting. We go from, burn her! That's from a movie. She's a witch, burn her. He goes from wanting to burn her, to condemn her for her harlotry, to what appears to be some form of a confession here. Not so much what he did, but rather he looks beyond the harlotry, if you will. He looks beyond seeking sexual favors from a prostitute. He looks beyond that and he goes to the fact that he realized that there was an offense committed by him because he did not follow through on providing his youngest son to her to fulfill his obligations as a father-in-law, to provide his oldest son with offspring. But it's interesting that he refers to her here as more righteous than himself, because nothing we've seen so far suggests that Tamar was righteous. Now, in comparison, maybe so. His point ultimately is that there was a cultural expectation, and we know that actually there was a godly expectation, because it tells us God was displeased with his son when he refused to provide offspring. And so there was both a cultural expectation, there was even a godly divine expectation, and he balked at it. He didn't fulfill it. That was an unrighteous act. Even though Tamar's behavior wasn't righteous, what she was seeking to accomplish was. And we have trouble with that sometimes, don't we? You know, the whole idea of the ends don't justify the means. We are never given permission in the scriptures to do unrighteous things to accomplish a righteous action. In fact, I might have shared with you before, there was a friend of mine who had been struggling with a wife. They were divorcing, and some of the things he was proposing to convict her of her sin were unrighteous things. And I would remind him, no, God doesn't want you to use unrighteous, wicked acts as a way to chastise your wife in hopes that she'll turn around and start acting righteously. God never gives us that kind of permission to do that. But there is an element of recognizing that her goal was a righteous goal. But again, his statement here does not or should not imply that she was righteous, but that her goal was a righteous one, but she certainly was more righteous than he, that he had failed miserably in his obligations to his daughter-in-law, to his oldest son, and ultimately to what God expected. What's interesting about this to me is that some, and I think that there's probably merit to this, some believe that this was a turning point in Judah's life. Because what we see in the rest of the Joseph story is a different kind of Judah. He takes responsibility. He rises up. He's a good son. Maybe this was a wake-up call for Judah. Don't really know. But there does seem to be a distinct difference between the Judah that we've seen so far in chapters 37 and 38 and what we see later in Judah. Enough to make us think, huh, was this a legitimate confession of sorts? Did he really mean, you know what? Yeah, she's more righteous than I because I failed in my obligation here. But, again, back to Tamar specifically, we really haven't seen anything in her here that would suggest that she was acting righteously. She could have just gone to Judah and said, hey, what about your son? You owe him to me. She could have followed a righteous, but she didn't. She took matters into her own hand, came up with a cunning plan, acted like a prostitute, behaved like a prostitute. So far, as I look through these passages, there's nothing about Judah, there's nothing about Tamar that would suggest that they would be major players in God's redemptive plan, or that they would have really any role in God's plan, but we find out that they did. So the third point today is that despite what we've learned about Judah and Tamar, we discover that God did indeed use them to further his redemptive plan. Look at verses 27 through 30. It came about at the time she was giving birth that, behold, there were twins in her womb. These are twins with her father-in-law, Judah. Moreover, it took place that while she was giving birth, one put out a hand, and the midwife took it and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying, "This one came out first." But it came about as he drew his hand back, and he pulled it back in, that behold, his brother came out. Then she said, "What a breach you have made for yourself." So he was named Perez. Afterward, his brother came out who had the scarlet thread on his hand, and he was named Zerah. So in essence, what's happening here is Zerah should have been the firstborn because he kind of poked his, you know, his arms out first. So he would have been the firstborn. So she tied the ribbon around his arm to show who the firstborn child is. Why? Firstborn child in the ancient Near East was really important. You've got the inheritance, you know, all that. But because he pulled his hand back in, and then all of a sudden Paris pops out. Paris was really the second born, not the firstborn. But you know what? It's interesting the way God does this. Sometimes bypasses the firstborn. Oftentimes bypasses the firstborn in favors. We saw that with Esau and Jacob. And we kind of see that undertone here. But what's most important about this is this name, Perez. Does that name sound familiar to you? It's actually found in the New Testament on at least two occasions. Both of which are in the genealogy of Jesus. Turn to Matthew. Matthew chapter 1. It is believed that Matthew chapter 1 is the lineage through Mary's line. We're just going to jump down into verse 3. We'll start with verse 2. Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers. Judah was the father of Perez, and Zerah by Tamar. Perez was the father of Hezron, and Hezron the father of Ram. What we're looking at here is go all the way back up into chapter 1, verse 1, the very first line. It says, these are the record of the genealogy of who? Jesus. And Perez is part of that lineage. Meaning Jesus Christ, in an earthly sense, was a descendant of Perez, which means he was a descendant of who? Tamar and Judah. God used Tamar and Judah, ultimately, to bring about the birth of Christ, to accomplish his redemptive plan. We see the same thing in Luke. Turn to Luke chapter 3. This is supposed to be the lineage of Joseph, but either way, Luke chapter 3, verse 33 says something very similar. If you read through this, what you have is the genealogy of Jesus. That's the title of the section. Starts up at verse 23. Jesus was supposed the son of Joseph, the son of Eli, the son of Matthat. Well, you keep reading. You go down to verse 33. And the son of Amminadab, the son of Admin, the son of Ram, the son of Hezron, and the son of who? Perez, the son of Judah. The son of Jacob, the son of Isaac. And so what we find in both genealogies in Matthew and Luke is that Perez was a part of the lineage of Jesus Christ. That Jesus Christ, the Messiah, God's Savior, the capstone to his redemptive plan, came through Judah and Tamar. Two individuals that we've seen so far today give us no impression that God would ever use them. Judah being who he was, Tamar being who she was. In fact, it's even a bit shocking that this line, Perez's birth, is what we would refer to here as an illicit birth. It came through an act of fornication with a woman who pretended to be a prostitute. You know, it's interesting, we see the same thing with David and the line of David through Bathsheba, because she's also in the lineage of Christ. Now, I don't know about you, but that's puzzling to me. But it tells us something about God. I want to look at three takeaways here as we look at these things. And the first one is obviously that God's plans cannot be thwarted by people behaving like Tamar and Judah. God had a redemptive plan. We find throughout the Old Testament there are all kinds of interesting things that would seem to throw a wrench into God's plan because people don't behave like you would expect them to behave. Abraham didn't really always behave like we'd expect him to behave. Isaac certainly didn't behave that way. Jacob didn't behave that way. Judah didn't behave that way. Tamar didn't behave that way. Even King David didn't behave that way. God has a plan, and there is nothing that is going to thwart that plan when it comes to us. Now, that doesn't mean he will always use individuals. What I mean by that is God will always accomplish his plan. It's either going to be through these unrighteous people or it'll be somebody else. But even though we have an individual, Judah, who pursued his own pleasures and everything else, it was God's plan to use him to bring about Christ. And that may be hard for us, but that was God's plan. And in spite of the fact that Judah was who he was, God chose to use him for that plan. And we have to be okay with that. And in some respects, that ought to give us comfort, should it not? I think back to Kimberly, you know? How can God use this? Doesn't matter. He used your fumbling words. He used this other young lady who came across as a little flirtatious and you thought derailed everything, but God's plan was exactly the way it worked out. So the first takeaway, I think, is that God's plan cannot be thwarted. He will accomplish it, and he will even use people like Tamar and Judah in the process. A second lesson I think we can take from this is, from Judah specifically, and it's this. When God intends to use us for his purpose, and we disregard him or his purpose, but his plan is still to use us, we run the risk of being corrected by him. Think about that for a moment. I'm sure Judah wasn't thinking, look at these great, glorious promises God gave to my father. He's going to build this great nation, you know? I'm going to stick it out here. I'm going to become part of this. No, he's like, I'm on my own. Busts off to Canaan, marries a Canaanite woman, hangs out with a Canaanite friend, you know, goes to a cultic prostitute, all those. He's not thinking at all about God's plan, but God's plan is, I'm going to use him. And it's interesting how the tables got turned, isn't it? Huh, she's more righteous than I am. He got humbled. He got caught in a trap. Who do you suppose really ultimately laid that trap? Do you think it was Tamar? No, I think it was God laying the trap for him. And part of the reason I believe that is because, again, we do seem to see a change in Judah. God used this episode in his life to shame him, to make him realize that he had not done what he was supposed to do, and that this woman who had seduced him was actually more righteous than he was. That's a low point. Have ever, any of you ever been in that position where an unsaved person makes you realize something about yourself? Maybe they behaved more righteous than you did? There's a tendency to make you think, doesn't it? I think those are times that are a good stiff rebuke from God. God's not afraid to use unrighteous people in our lives to bring some attention to us, to correct our behavior, especially when his intent is to use us. You know, the scriptures tell us that God actually chastises us. Imagine that. Why? Because he wants to use us. We're part of his redemptive plan. We're part of the church, the body of Christ. And when we don't behave like God wants us to behave, or needs us to behave, if you can say it that way, what does he do? He rebukes us, disciplines us. Hebrews chapter 12. Turn there with me. It's a long passage, but we're going to read it. Hebrews chapter 12. Chapter, verse 1. Since we have, therefore, a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance, that's essentially sin, and the sin which so easily entangles us. Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, the life in Christ. Fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him, Christ, who endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. What? Meaning, don't lose heart, don't become weary. Continue to grow and live and act like a follower of Jesus Christ. Verse 4, for you have not resisted to the point of shedding blood in your striving against sin, and you have forgotten the exhortation which is addressed to you as sons. My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor faint when you are reproved by him. For those whom the Lord loves, he disciplines, and he scourges every son whom he receives. It is for discipline that you endure. God deals with you as sons, for what son is there whom his father does not discipline? But if you are without discipline, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. He goes on, and you can read the rest of that yourself. But the point is, the Lord disciplines us. And he disciplines us because he loves us. He wants us to grow and mature in our relationship with Christ. He wants us to flee sin and to pursue righteousness. But also, he wants to use us. And obviously, people that are behaving appropriately will seek out God's purpose and plan. And so much like Judah, God's intent was to use Judah. I believe that what we see happen with his daughter-in-law was God rebuking him, shaming him, turning him around, disciplining him for his purposes. And I think the same thing happens to us. So when we choose to pursue our own path and disregard God's purpose and plan and just live life without even any thought of how does God want to use me, I think that's the average Christian. God is a genie in a bottle. We rub the bottle, he gives us all the great things for us, and life is ours to enjoy instead of going, wait a minute, how does God want to use me? What role do I play in his purpose and his plan? And sometimes when we're like that, God has to rebuke us. He has to discipline us to get our attention. And again, there ought to be comfort in that. We ought to be encouraged by that because it tells us God loves us and wants to use us. The last takeaway that I'll mention here is from Tamar. And it's as simple as God uses not only the righteous, but the unrighteous to accomplish his plan. Again, that's a hard thing for us to sometimes think about or accept. While Judah declares that Tamar was more righteous than he was, that's not a declaration saying she's a righteous person, but rather he's making a contrast and a comparison there. Her goal was actually a righteous goal. Again, it was at the heart of God that her first husband would have children and pass on his name. It displeased the Lord when his brother didn't fulfill that obligation. It displeased the Lord here when Judah didn't fulfill his obligation, when he deceived his daughter-in-law. And so there was a righteous cause there, but it doesn't necessarily make all of her actions righteous. But the reality of it is, in spite of her unrighteous actions, God actually did use her. We've already seen that it was through her and her child Perez that God brings about the Messiah. And again, that's hard for us to wrap our head around that. But God uses both good and bad situations. He uses both right and wrong behavior on our part. He chooses to use us in spite of sometimes our unrighteous actions and behavior. That doesn't give us license to do it, though, does it? It just tells us about God. Doesn't give us permission. Doesn't mean we should say, God's fine with unrighteousness. He'll bless me anyway. That's not at all what the scriptures teach. But it does tell us that God can take any situation, any circumstance, and any individual, no matter how much they screw up. I mean, think about it. Judah really tried to booger this thing up, didn't he? And all the things we learned about him. But he wasn't able to booger it up. Likewise, Tamar wasn't able to booger it up. God still used her and her unrighteousness to accomplish his purpose and plan. That takes me back to the illustration that I started with. So Kimberly's whole situation there. I didn't know how God may or may not use that. I just was convinced, honey, you know what? God's going to use your effort there. You may never know, but he will, because that's the kind of God he is. Maybe one of those tracts you did leave there, maybe somebody will get that and read it. You don't know. It's not your concern. Your concern should be, I was faithful, God can use it. Move on. Go to the next restaurant. Well, this week, yesterday actually, got a text from her. See if I can find it. It's not like, oh wow, you know, half the staff got saved kind of a thing. But I'm just going to read this to you. I think it's pretty cool here. An El Jalisco, that's the name of the restaurant, an El Jalisco update. Our server was very sweet, meaning she went there again the other night, and his name was Christian. You know, some of them are very busy and they're very rushed. They give that vibe off, you know, they can't really talk. Some seem to be like they want to joke around. Others seem very soft-natured. Well, that was Christian. Interestingly, the server who served some friends of hers and me during the 1st of May, his name was Jesus. And he also seemed very soft-natured and warm. But anyway, when I gave him the bag, meaning her bag of tracks and stuff, with stuff in it, he was happy, and he smiled, and he shook my hand. By closing, when a lot of us were leaving, I was able to clear part of the table, hand a couple of them plates and stacking stuff, and some of them watched and smiled, and one of them said, gracias, at me, and I think he wanted to ask if I had been in the restaurant industry or other things, but he couldn't speak English very well, so I just did my best to communicate with him. Finally, Domingo cashed us out. He is the one who asked us how old we were last time. This is the guy she's like, see, she's flirting with him, and he's now asking us questions like, aren't you, you know, what's your age, instead of asking us about stuff we're sharing with him. She was all concerned. He's probably the manager, she capitalized. And he really liked my black pen, and he wanted it. So I gave him my black pen, and he gave me an El Jalisco pen, and I gave him the bag also. It went very, very, very well last night. Hannah said that she's pretty sure that they're beginning to recognize me now. So all of that to say, yeah, did anybody get saved? We don't know. But even this last comment, her friend Hannah, who goes there, they're starting to recognize who you are. She's the girl that brings us tracks. There's another individual there she mentions that they think might actually be a Christian, but he mentioned, I don't get a chance to go to church because I'm working here all the time. Well, so Kimberly then went to her boss, who speaks fluent Spanish. Her boss gave her a link to a church that does Spanish services. It's online. And Kimberly's like, can I add this to my little packet of stuff? So I put together business cards for her. Haven't printed them out yet, but sent it to her and said, okay, here's a QR code. They can click this. You can put this with your little packet. So now her intent is to start putting that in her packet where they can get some good Bible teaching, because there's no Spanish-speaking churches down there where she's at. But again, my point is, I got that email. I thought, see, Kimberly? You thought that you had just boogered everything up. You know, what a disaster. God can't possibly use this, but she's back there at the restaurant. Everything's back to kind of normal in some respects. She's still having conversation. They're getting to know who she is. She got a chance to encourage a Christian there. Got a chance to give more Bible tracts to the manager of the restaurant. One of the guys even said thank you to her. God can use anything. And we see that in the passage today. Even stuff like that, that you go, that was a bad situation. I did more damage than good. No, the reality is, God uses it. Amen?